It's I'm honored and humbled to be speaking here today, and for my British friends, this is a citation from Theresa May, just appointed Prime Minister. I wish sincerely to thank you, the conference organizers, and ISFM for the opportunity. I fully subscribe to the words that the president of ISFM said in her opening speech, that we should look at the EU refugee crisis as only a relatively small fraction of within the global refugee crisis. But I think we should also remember the genealogy of the current global refugee regime and where it comes from, and the importance that Europe refugees had in the way that the regime has been setting up, because this can help us maybe to understand the direction that the system will develop, starting from this European crisis. I wish also to record my debt of gratitude to Professor Roger Zetter, who introduced me to the study of refugee studies 15 years ago, and today is turning 70. So what I want to start with is it's reflecting on how the dead bodies of migrants have been grieved during the refugee crisis. On October the 4th, 2013, while the then Prime Minister of Italy, Enrico Letta, announced in a public speech that Italian citizenship was to be awarded to the victim of the Lampedusa shipwreck that had claimed over 300 lives, and the Rome City Council organized a vigil for the dead migrants, offering housing to 155 of them, in Sicily, the public prosecutor opened an investigation for clandestine migration against the survivors. And hundreds of migrants rescued at sea and brought to Lampedusa just hours before the tragedy were crammed inside the overcrowded room of the Lampedusa reception center waiting for identification. These papers aim to offer a reading of the Mediterranean migration crisis through the lens of the migrants' dead bodies and the politics of mourning surrounding this tragic incident that have caused over 9,000 victims since October 2013. My starting point is twofold. Migrant dead bodies have been cried and decried by a range of institutional and non-institutional actors to fit different political narratives and agendas. And institutional responses to the so-called Mediterranean migration crisis in Italy, as it, like in Europe, have been ambivalent and contradictory. The EU, in particular, has lacked to speak with one voice on this issue, and its response has been mostly reactive to tragic incidents that led to thousands of lost lives at sea. Deaths that were in many ways preventable. Nonetheless, in foregrounding the politics of mourning, this paper shed light on the complex relationship between the development of the EU immigration agenda and sea migrants' dead bodies, or their absence, and show how it is shaping the emerging post-Arab Spring migration regime in the Mediterranean. The paper asks, what if those dead bodies are no longer there or are no longer visible? How does this absence affect the EU and EU state response to irregular crossings? So what I'm gonna do is, I'll give a brief introduction to the crisis, but I will try to develop a dual narrative. So I want to look at the crisis and the crisis at the same time, and try to see, to while presenting the facts, also highlighting some cracks that may help us to understand a bit more what's going on here. Then I want to look at two different processes. One is what I call the movement from death to action, and the other one is the pendulum, is from action to death. And try in the end to try to reconcile this action that the EU as a EU state has have engaged with through some sort of reflection about the spectacle of the border control, border externalization. So the first aim is, let's say, then naturalize the crisis. The first thing I did was to find a map without borders, just to confuse a little bit the things. So we have seen some of this data already. Yesterday, over 1 million people arrived irregularly in Greece and Italy in 2015. 845,000 had traveled to Greece, and 153,000 arrived from Libya to Italy, mostly from Libya. 3,771 people died during that year. if we try to disaggregate this big number, the 3,700, but looking not just at the crisis as one, but looking at the major route, you start to see a slightly different picture. Is it one crisis or two, I'm asking? The two main routes, the Central Mediterranean one and the Aegean one, are different in terms of country of origin, age profile, gender composition. Is this a Syrian refugee crisis? As very often the UNHCR reminds us, over 50%, 56% of the arrival in Greece were from Syria alone. And 96 of the... But this is not true if you look at Italy in 2015. So if you look at the arrival of Syrians in Italy, it's just 5% of the population. There is a story here, an aspect of this crisis which is interesting, is the significance of the category of the other, that in Greece count for about 4% of... if you have 96% of the belong to the top five countries, and then you have about 4.5% which belong to others. If you look at the Italy case, this category is, if you take out the first five nationalities, you got over 41% of others. This means there is a much different, there is not just a diversity in terms of country of origin, but it's also a diversity in terms of migration histories that we need to account in the narrative of the crisis. Another aspect which is very important, because then it makes us think and then naturalize, when we think about the migration crisis and immediately we think at the Syrian family of refugees, then it's an image that doesn't talk to also a significant part of the people that arrived, and then we really need to think about the policy implication of that. Another data which is quite familiar is about the fact that in Greece you have the top 89% of the arrival come from the top 10 refugee producing countries. I'll come back later about this definition of the top 10 refugee producing countries. It's only 25% for Italy. This is our data from 2016. And yet a big difference is the relation of families or singles. So the migration towards Italy is mostly from single men, young single men between 20 and 30. While, especially in 2015 and even before in 2014, in Greece you have a much larger presence of families. This is also the implication in the way that we present and think about the crisis. What is interesting is also look at these flows over time. What is striking, for example, is the fact that in Greece you had 43,000 arrivals in 2014. That jumped to over 800,000 in 2015, and now we're then back to 158,000 this year. Basically stopped, the flow stopped on the 24th March, with just a few people managing to cross since then. The other big difference that is interesting and has relevance in terms of the way we conceptualize the crisis is, for example, if you look at the case of Italy, is the disappearance of the Syrians. So I said before, in 2015, you had about 5% of the arrival were Syrians, but the year before, this was over 25%. What does it mean, the disappearance of the Syrians, in terms of the narrative, in terms of the policy response, is quite something very important to think about. And finally, a more general point about the crisis. In 2014, we were talking already about refugee crisis. At that point, the overall arrival were about 200,000 in terms of irregular crossing. 2015, the following year, this exceeded 1 million. This year is down again to about 250,000. It's a question of how big needs to be a flow of forced displaced people in order for this to be called a crisis. And this is something that makes us think about the construction and production of the crisis discourse and what kind of agenda it serves. And I want to give you an example, just because I could not leave outside any reference to Brexit in the talk, I'm afraid, about the way in which the narratives and significance in terms of numbers, I think, is more striking, and is the case of Britain. So if you look at the chart on top, you have it shows the number of asylum applications in Europe between 2005 and 2015. The blue part at the bottom is basically the share of asylum application of the UK over this period. As you can see, despite the refugee crisis in Europe has happened, this is not attached in any way in the UK. Even if you look at the number of unaccompanied minors, you've got a very tiny increase. It has nothing to do with the number you have seen, for example, in Sweden. So there has been no refugee crisis in the UK. However, the week before the referendum, the Brexit referendum, you got this poster being circulated all over the country about the US failed us with the long queue of mostly like Syrian and Afghani refugees. This, I guess, is a photo from Slovenia from the last summer. And it's really interesting. So these people have never arrived to UK. But this also tells us about how the Christ discourse has been used within other arena, political arena. And in UK has been particularly striking because the research that my colleague Simon and other colleagues at Comedy have carried out about the refugee crisis has shown very clearly that the UK tabloid, the media representation of the crisis, has had a very large role within the UK media, particularly the tabloid, despite the fact of the number were not matching this sort of moral panic that was produced by the media. It's really interesting this mismatch, but it also highlights issues of power and representation that we need to consider. I think though we need to broaden up the issues about, obviously very easy to blame Farage and the UKIP, or very easy to blame the Daily Mail and the Sun, or Murdoch Sun. I think there are other issues that are really interesting in the way that the narrative or the discourse around the crisis have been put together. And I was joking before about that in one slide I managed to criticize two of the largest agencies that works on the crisis. And I think the politics of naming and counting have played a very significant role in the way that the crisis has been constructed. An interesting example, we saw yesterday, I think in the presentation that we gave from the Medmic project, was about the arrival of irregular arrival in Italy over the period of 2002 and 2015. As you can see, there has been clearly a peak with the Arab Spring and the Arab Springs in 2011, and then there is a recent peak now. What is interesting, though, is that all the data from the first part, so between 2002 and 2011, more or less, are referred to as detected irregular crossings. And in more recent tables, instead, is used the irregular numbers. These are the regular migrants. So there is this change between the detection and basically the association of detection with the real number. Which obviously, if you're just familiar with the way that the Mediterranean as a liquid border has been patrolled, it's quite striking. You know, you didn't have the NATO patrolling the Mediterranean before the Libya war. You didn't have a Frontex in the middle of the Mediterranean. Before, and this is quite interesting, when you were talking about irregular migrants and irregular migrants arrivals, you were looking about the boat that they were landing on the beaches in Italy or in Greece, undetected boats. So the larger part of this irregular population, irregular migrants, were actually not detected. And now suddenly we've got a different process. This is interesting also because it's telling us something about the way that the governance of the irregular mobility within irregular crossing within Mediterranean has changed. Because nowadays you don't have any more, at least in Italy, so-called spontaneous arrival. So everyone is detected before. So in a sense, the fact that they are counting the detected as regular migrants is more or less reliable. It's applying to the past that is wrong. And creating this narrative of the invasion, that is quite crucial because you have a very clear line that for the first 10 years is showing a very low number, then it goes up. The other issue that's also in relation to Frontex that has been particularly active in creating this climate of panic is the idea of issues of double counting. So in a sense they conflate irregular crossings with irregular migrants when they talk about the arrival at the EU external borders. And they've also submitted this and wrote about this in the past. I want to also though mention another thing, which is about the use of the top 10 refugee producing countries. This is something that UNHCR use when they talk about the crisis. I think it's very interesting, and you understand the logic, because obviously you are basically making a claim for the certainness for the people that arrive in Greece, because obviously over 90% of them, they come from refugee producing countries. However, if you look at these terms, this label, applied within the Italian case, then it's much more problematic, because it's really much following, pushing somehow, an approach which is country-based, which is actually contrary to the principle of the Geneva Convention. So you need really to think about and disaggregate the crisis according to the different routes, because it makes significant difference in terms of policy impacts and the way that the major actors are operating. And finally, IOM. I use data about the death rate, the number of deaths in the sea, about death and missing people, which is really important and the way they are documenting and counting. It's interesting that until a few years ago, it was an Italian blogger that was collecting the numbers of people that they were dying on a spontaneous way, underpaid, without anyone funding him. And then gradually, this number got co-opted in by the larger organization. This is something interesting to think about. What's the power of number accounting within the crisis? It's something we really need to consider. But what is interesting is in this recent research, report was published, I think, in 2014, and recently again, the Mediterranean is called the deadliest sea in the world. And here is an example of numbers. So the Mediterranean, they're counting 2,900 people. Then there's the Middle East, 81, North Africa, 342. And the Caribbean is 44, obviously. And again, for the people, there is not the same level of border control in all the seas of the globe, so of the world. So just sort of producing an image that they are able to count all the people that drown at sea all over the world is basically fundamentally misleading. This doesn't mean that there are not people dying in the Mediterranean, and that the counting is very important. But creating this image of the Mediterranean as the center of the world is something that contributes very much to what we said at the beginning about producing an image of the refugee crisis, which is very much inflated within the global refugee crisis. Another aspect of the crisis that I think is particularly concerning is this construction, the dangerous construction of the good refugees and its implication. Partly, coming back to what I said before about the way that we are gradually seeing the definition of a refugee is applied according to the country of nationality or specifically family status or the good family, or also about the specific age or religion. It's really important because in a way undermines the position and the claims of the other refugees. And this, while maybe not that significant within some contexts where the very large majority of people comes from specific countries, is also creating a problem, for example, in Italy, in at least two dimensions, two senses. One is about, and we need to think about in relation to the talk, is the impact of the fact that there are not good refugees in Italy in terms of putting resources in doing the search and rescue operation, which has an impact about the mortality rate of this, you see? And the second one, and it's also interesting, is that graph there, which shows that Italy has always had a different profile of the asylum applications in terms of country of origin. So yeah, they always had a very significant presence of Western, Eastern African nations. It's also had in the past a much higher recognition rate for this nationality. However, since the process of Europeanization of the crisis has come more and more into force, which is mostly since the summer 2015, but more during the autumn, what you see is a significant increase in the number of rejected asylum applications from the nationality that before were encountered a more positive response, particularly with temporary subsidiary protection, and a decline very clearly of the subsidiary protection. So what you see is that if you then apply the refugee crisis lens in the Italian case, basically you got groups that previously were received a better treatment and now are marginalized. And within the debate in Italy, now we talk about the production of illegality as a result of the hotspot system. There is also another implication, which is about what I call the national order of things, that the definition of the good refugee as not something which is uncontested. Just think, for example, about the criteria that are applied by the UK for the resettlement scheme for the Syrians. So they look for the most vulnerable of the vulnerable. That's more or less the definition that the then PM David Cameron has used to refer to the people that were deserving the help of the UK. Within the German context, instead, the good refugee is much more the work-active Syrian that is able to receive protection and then contribute to the job market quite soon. So there is much more on investment, for example, in terms of training courses, language classes, etc., etc. So these are two good refugees that are sort of diverging in terms of the way that you think about the so-called crisis. Now, moving more to the core of the discussion here, I want to look at issues related to the mortality rate of linked to the regular crossing in the Mediterranean. And a very basic element. So we saw at the beginning the 3,771 dead or missing people in 2015. the picture will become really more interesting if you disaggregate it by the route. So you can see that while in 2015 over 85%, almost 85% of the arrival came into Greece, only 21% of the dead and missing were in Greece or in the crossing between the Turkey and Greece. This means that while 1 in 53 people died crossing the central Mediterranean route, 1 in 1,049 died crossing the Eastern Med route. Now there is obviously a geographical reason for this. There's the distance. Obviously, we know that the Aegean crossing is much shorter; it's about 10 kilometers in many cases between the Lesbos and the Turkish coast. When you talk about the crossing between Libya and Italy, we're talking about 600 kilometers or 300 kilometers to get to Lampedusa. So it's a much more difficult open sea. But there is something more, and I will come back later. So the focus here is not exactly only on the dead bodies. And as I said, there are migrants that die at sea, not just in the Mediterranean, but also as well. But it's about the way that these bodies are moved. So the kind of question I'm trying to answer is, how have dead bodies impacted on the EU response to the refugee crisis? Who does cry and claim whom? But also, do all bodies count the same? And in what way the absence or the invisibility of dead bodies may impact on the EU response? And we are already seeing some worrying signs here. So the three crucial moments, I think, there is a fourth one, which is the invisible one. Three crucial moments within the narrative of the crisis have been the tragedies of the shore of Lampedusa in October 2013, where over 300 people died at sea. The incident in Libya, off the coast of Libya mostly, but then in April 2015, that in just 1 week caused over 1,200 deaths. And finally, Alan Kurdi death on the beach of Turkey. And I didn't want to use the photo that everyone is familiar with. This is the last photo of Alan Kurdi before he died. So as a result of this event, it is also interesting to see who went to the funeral, for example. You can see a very high profile representation in the Lampedusa one, when there's the Italian Prime Minister and there was President Barroso of the European Commission, but also the Commissioner for Cecilia Malmström and the Mayor of Lampedusa, Nicolini. The second one, there seems to be a stronger representation of the home affairs. So there is Avramopoulos, there is also Alfano, that is the Minister of the Interior. What followed the first accident is the launch of the Operation Mare Nostrum, that I guess most people are familiar with, that in 12 months saved, rescued over 150,000 people. What followed the tragedies of April 2015 has been the change from the introduction of what we call the Triton Plus operation, in which Frontex was a EU-led operation, which had an hybrid mandate of border control and rescue, although it was not fully acknowledged for quite a while. But what is interesting is also that compared to the previous EU operation had the same kind of resources that was put by Mare Nostrum in terms of human resources and funding. Finally, what followed the Alan Kurdi was the de facto suspension of the Dublin regulation, opening up in a significant way of the Balkan route, and everyone remembers the image we saw, which led in October alone to over 200,000 arrival of the Greek coast. But what makes this incident different is also important to ask. So first of all, there is an issue of logistics. As you can see, there's a famous photo of a boat crossing between Libya and Italy that was that is basically what I want to point out is if you have a large boat, you have also potentially a large tragedy. And it seems like that, especially in the first part of the crisis, in order to have that kind of response from the European institution, you need to have a large tragedy. So it was the response, the reaction was very much based on the size and the number of people that died. we got a completely different picture with the Alan Kurdi case, because obviously before and after that Alan Kurdi died on that beach, there have been kids that died. So why that one became significant, I mean, it's quite interesting as well. So if you think about Lampedusa, you got a number of elements which are interesting. The large number of people that died, the proximity, so the distance, the proximity to the Europe shores. You had the new Pope that did his first foreign visit on Lampedusa just a few weeks before, and he was very strongly worded after the accident. And you also have a technocratic government in place led by Letta, who is a strong Catholic hitter, so he's not an elected politician. In the case of Libya, I think you still got this, it's interesting because obviously 1,200 people was by far the largest, worst week in this refugee crisis up until recently. And it's interesting because at that point it was just opposed to the narrative of the pull factor, especially the UK government was pushing. As a result of that crisis, and this was before the UK election, David Cameron and Nick Clegg wrote an article in The Guardian which sort of were acknowledging the fact that the pull factor was a little bit, or not a great idea to use as a concept in reference to this, although they went back on their position, especially Cameron, after a few months. Also, the role of the civic society was extremely important in making those bodies visible and counting. So there was this idea of putting pressure that was really important. This was the there was a very strong response in terms of asking for the European Union's sympathetic position on the refugees. The Turkey, in the case of Alan Kurdi in Turkey, is different because, as I said, it's one boy against a mass. He's a Western-looking Syrian deserving refugee boy. And this was following months of image of the crossing, irregular crossing of the borders with Hungary. So it's really interesting to see, to think about the significance of this photo. And the next photo is upsetting, I will move quickly, sorry. Because there is, as I said before, many other kids that we didn't see. And this is one. So when we're talking about the April 2015 accident that claimed the life of 1,200 migrants, we didn't see this photo. This photo appeared and disappeared from the social media very rapidly. It didn't have any coverage like the Alan Kurdi one. When the photo of Alan Kurdi was posted on social media, received 20 million visualization in 12 hours. 20 million visualization in 12 hours. And it's also by study done by the University of Sheffield is highlighting the fact that it produced a shift in the way that we're talking about the crisis, with the use of refugee as a term gaining much more traction than word migrant afterwards. Then it was a change again with the column event in December. So I think that is we need to think about, and it's something that has been put forward in the criticism of some part of the refugee studies scholarship, is to think about the category of race and ethnicity within the study of forced migration, both to understand the treatment that people receive, but also the other categories of status and ethnicity intersect, including specific location. I think and it's important to think about the person and the boy that we haven't cried about. Because as Judith Butler points out, if the forms of public grief that are available to us demonstrate the norms which the human is constituted by, we are as much constituted by those we do grieve as by those whose deaths are met with silence. And I think the racialized dead bodies is an important absence within the narrative of the refugee crisis. And partly this is important because when we see a change of search and rescue operation in the central Mediterranean route, let's not forget that now the largest part of arrival are Western and Eastern Africans. The Syrians are no longer there, and there are no longer white refugees or migrants arriving along that route. So, as I was saying, this is the response, so moving from death to action. So, response to those tragedies that we have seen, some kind of opening from European states, from the European Union, some call for more solidarity, etc. But we also have the complete opposite dynamic here. So a movement from action to death. And I'll just ask if we can talk about the victims of the EU border regime. So after 12 months of the Mare Nostrum program, the Italy asked very strongly the European Union to take the lead in the search and rescue operation. What was proposed was not the search and rescue operation, but was a border police operation led by Frontex. As a result of that, in the first four months of 2015, compared to the first 4 months of the 2014, so during the first 4 months of 2014, we had Mare Nostrum. During the first month of the 2015, you got Trident. You have a change between 17 to 900 deaths along the same route. What we see now is, for example, another event is the EU-Turkey deal and the involvement of the NATO. We need to think about if it has had an impact on death rates on the Aegean route, and also sub-assemble it. But what we see as well is the criminalization of solidarity and civic societies. We have seen increasingly, for example, access to the Greek island or to the center being monitored, the registration being required. We have seen cases of persecution from people giving a lift to refugees in Denmark. We have seen, for example, the criminalization of the Spanish lifeguard in Greece as well. So that you see a movement towards the militarization of the reception and search and rescue. You still got international actors involved, but their position is becoming more problematic within the current settings. And finally, you got all the push towards the border externalization, the proposal of the migration compact that was put forward by the Italian government, but also the Khartoum process and the Valletta summit, so the attempt to replicate the same trend of approach we used within the deal with Turkey to the Europe relation with the African states, in which the issue, the conditionality of development aid is becoming corely linked to border policing. And it's nothing new because everyone remembers the readmission agreement with Gaddafi, Libya. The image there shows the difference in terms of the area covered by the rescue mission between Mare Nostrum and Triton. As you can see, the location, the X sign indicated the location where the major accident happened. And obviously, Mare Nostrum covering the red area was able to intervene in some of these incidents, while if the Triton mission was much closer to the European coastline and with an unclear mandate in terms of rescue. And the differences are striking in terms of the resources put in the two missions and also the reliance on commercial vessels and private actors for doing the rescue operation. So when we see the big accident in April 2015, that caused 1,200 people dying, this is from a research carried out by Goldsmith College as part of the SRC program that does a work of forensic oceanographic. So they look at the movement of the boats that intervene into the rescue operation and the position in time of the boats that basically the shipwreck. And it's really interesting because one of the key causes of that accident was the fact that the commercial vessel didn't have the resources to do a saving operation that was involving hundreds of people at a time. So part of the problem there that was when the commercial vessel get close to save people, collided with the one of the boats and one of the boats sank. So there was an issue of relying too much on commercial vessels rather than having trained coastal guard intervene. So going back about the link between death at sea and the variation in death rates, I think it's quite striking to compare the first 5 months of 2014, 2015, and 2016. And the reason why I limited this period is because normally from May onward, you got much more involvement of privately owned boat, like the MSF boat or MOAS boat. So the winter months are the ones that rely more strongly on just the official search and rescue operation. And what you see here, that between 2014, 2015, 2016, while you didn't have a significant change over the first 4 months, the overall number of arrival in Italy, what you see is a very significant increase in the number of people that died from 1% to 4.3%. If we look at the other route, the eastern route is also interesting. As I said before, in 2015, one person every 100,000, 49, died crossing the route. The first 4 months of 2016, when you have the involvement of the NATO, you have the criminalization of the volunteers, you have a much stricter approach taken by the Turkish Coast Guard, you get the death rate going to 1 in 419. So it became much more deadly. Now the question we should ask, if you think about the narrative and about the crisis and the fact that a lot of the intervention of the European Union is based on the fact that there is a war against smugglers going on, which route will you be intervening? Will you be intervening on the safest one or the most deadly one? It's clear that they closed the safest route, not the most deadly one. They closed the Greek-Turkish route, and that was as a result of the Turkey-Europe deal. So now, how do we explain these two processes? That reaction of solidarity following major tragedies, at the same time, policies that have more or less directly effect on death at sea. I think it's quite interesting to think about two bodies of literature here that I think are relevant. Is the work, for example, of Weber and Pickering around the link between border policies and death, which don't really occur in the neighboring, on the border of the European Union or the state, but in gradually happening farther and far. So the case, for example, of the people which we don't see, so the people that die in the desert, for example, we don't count them. This doesn't mean that people don't die. Or the people that die in the deserts of Mexico trying to cross into the US. So there is an issue of visibility and invisibility that is core of the narrative of the crisis that we need to unpack and being aware of. So I think it's also the work of Ruben Anderson on the EU border apparatus in West Africa is important in the sense of showing the way that the governance of illegal migration operate well beyond the border of Europe, and this work it really shows. And it's particularly the idea of the bioeconomy produced by the crisis. So it means we need to remember that there is a lot of money involved in the governance of this crisis. The security industries, the production of border technologies, there is a circulation of knowledge between various countries, including the US, Israel, and the European Union. There is an interest in keeping the narrative of the crisis going. And there is also, though, and I think we need to think about also a nexus between the security and humanitarian sector in this. So in a sense, if you look at the amount of visibility and funding that some of the organizations have generated throughout the crisis, this generates somehow an incentive to keep the crisis going. So it was very interesting, for example, looking at the data from the first 4 months. The post-March numbers of arrival between Turkey and Greece. So the moment that the crisis in Greece disappeared, suddenly we see a lot of emphasis about the arrival in Italy again. So there is a shift of the narrative towards Italy. Everyone was waiting for the Syrians arriving from Libya or from Egypt. And if you look at the number, there was only an increase with the previous year of less than, I think, was 1%. So the increase in arrival after the closure of their route is minimal. It doesn't involve the Syrian necessarily. But if you look at the media representation instead, you will not understand. So there is clearly the crisis narrative has a life of its own, and we need to understand what are the underpinning power and economic relations that support it. I think it is also the work. So there is something about the death at distance, the death nearby, and this is the work of Nicolas de Genova and Achille Mbembe, I think are interesting to understand what the German called the schizophrenic border spectacle. So the idea that the sovereignty of EU is constructed by its capacity of enacting differential treatment of rights, differing between categories of people, different purposes within the same space. And so this is also introduced the idea of racialization I mentioned before. But then how do you reconcile then the securitization with the humanitarian narrative then? And recently, Steele has reflected on the significance of the official commemoration, what I was talking before about the politics of mourning, highlighting how official commemoration practice employed by state and EU leaders do not transform or unsettle our understanding of citizenship and community. They create a humanitarian exception and disconnect the death from the violent politics of the EU-European borders regime. So it seems like the humanitarian obligation vis-à-vis the people that die has nothing to do with the political responsibility, and in a way enables the European not to question the political responsibility for both the death. So it serves that purpose. So what you see now, when we talk about death and trying to look not just at the visible one, but also the invisible one, I try to think about what are the strategies of managing dead bodies in the crisis. And identify three different main strategies that they are not mutually exclusive. First one is the absent death. So the person who is rescued at sea, the saving human campaign. So the humanitarian approach, let's save humans so they don't die, which is crucial and important. The second aspect is the distance. So closing routes, like in case of the EU-Turkey border or this the externalization proposal, the idea is closing routes with more or less covert operation against smugglers and facilitators and signing bilateral agreements so that the death happened farther afar. The first one is the invisibilization of the death. This is done, for example, by censorship and sanitizing the language. So they never talk about let's do war on smugglers. They do about dismantling a traffickers network. So they talk about collateral damage when they were talking about intersecting boats with human beings on board if there was someone dying. So there was a language then. But there is also something else, which is for example, the image of the young girl, African girl that we didn't see. So this image was considered offensive for our sensibility. So it was not the fact that the young girl died that was offensive, it was the image that was offensive for our sensibility, so we were not allowed to see. And many newspapers on that basis didn't publish it. And finally, this is back at the fourth accident, is this what I call the ghost accident in April 2016, when basically, apparently, hundreds of people died off the coast of Egypt. And for days, we didn't know if this had happened or not. The people that were the survivors were taken to Greece, and only after a few days, they started to be emerging that an accident had happened. And this happened because the Somali government, through the Somali diaspora, start to count the people that were not, that we didn't know where they were. So it was very interesting, this a process of invisibilization of the people that died, as a way of understanding the direction that the approach to the crisis is going. By making this appear, the dead bodies, we have a strengthening of the securitization discourse, more and more. So in conclusion, I think that the EU politics of mourning is anchored to the parcel of the Mediterranean Sea closer to the EU border, as if no moral or political responsibility extends beyond that area. The war of smugglers to avoid migrant death is contradicted by the evidence that show that it was the safest route that was locked down, not the most dangerous one where the smuggler operates. It also was the one that was cheaper for people to travel. And finally, I think that the emphasis on dismantling traffickers' networks, sometimes they're called as modern slave traders, misunderstand obviously the difference between causes and means. So they think that by stopping the means of transport, they solve the root causes. But they are not so naive. I think that what this approach really reveals is a deeper truth about the policy goal of the EU and EU states, which is keep undesirable population away, dead or alive, to all costs. Thank you.